So our first presenter for today is Marion Reif, and she is a researcher at the Penn Center for the Integration of Genetic Healthcare Technologies. She has a PhD in sociomedical sciences, a master's in social work, and a master's in social work and social policy, and training in anthropology. She specializes in mixed methods research, investigating the cultural context of health and medicine, and currently is a PI on a study exploring experiences of families having genome-wide testing for the autism spectrum disorder. So, come on up.
Hi. I'm going to talk about a study that we've been doing at Penn, looking at the impact of microarray testing. And I'm going to talk about the data that we have from three different studies and then try to get to the question of what do we do about that. So I'm going to sort of fairly quickly go through the data, and then hopefully we'll have time to discuss some of the implications of that. I don't have any relationships to disclose. Chromosomal microarray testing. Is that better? Okay. CMA, or chromosomal microarray, was introduced clinically in 2008. When it was first introduced, it was considered to be transformative, having unprecedented power to detect genomic variations, but many of them were of uncertain clinical significance. And it is increasingly utilized in pediatric diagnostic testing. It's used primarily to find the cause for presenting problems, including congenital anomalies, developmental delays, and autism spectrum disorders. It's also useful in clarifying prognosis in some cases, and it allows for early screening and interventions, and as well for reproductive risk counseling. It was brought in 2010 as a first-tier clinical diagnostic test for children with developmental disabilities and congenital anomalies, and it is considered standard and practice, and it's recommended to be used for the postnatal reporting of postnatal copy number variants. With the increased use of genetic testing, many people are finding causes for the problems that their children have. This is just an example from the media. So it does improve the diagnostic rate. It's a higher resolution test than has previously been done, but there are problems because it detects variations, and it's been found that these kinds of variations also occur in phenotypically normal individuals. So it is difficult sometimes for the lab to determine what is a normal variation and what is a pathogenic one. And there are several criteria that they have to determine that. But it frequently uncertainties arise in the interpretation of the results. In 80% of tested cases, the result is negative. It's considered normal. In about 10%, it's a pathogenic, definite pathogenic result. And in the other 10%, it's what's considered a variant of uncertain significance, where the lab has to make a determination based on the size of the deletion or duplication, whether they see it in databases of controls, and whether they have data on the genes in the region or not. So we were interested in finding out what the impact is on families and providers of the uncertainties in microarray testing. And we looked at that in three different studies, starting with a qualitative exploratory study using content and thematic analyses, and then using an online survey with statistical analysis. I'm going to talk about three of the studies that we've done. The first was interviews with parents of children who have been tested using microarrays. There were 25 children and 31 parents interviewed. The second was with genetics professionals, including medical geneticists and genetic counselors. And the third is an online survey of providers who have ordered CMA, including geneticists as well as non-genetics providers, pediatricians, and other subspecialties like neurology and developmental pediatricians. We used a framework, a conceptual framework, to analyze the results, and we didn't use this up front, but having done the interviews and having done the analyses, we then found that our data fit very well with this taxonomy. So we used this just to provide some kind of framework for analyzing the results. And they have different domains of uncertainty, including practical and levels of uncertainty, which include the things about healthcare delivery and quality of care, scientific sources, which are about the actual illness and the causality, and personal sources of uncertainty, which have to do with the effects of the illness on people's sense of meaning, life goals, and relationships. And the question is, which of these uncertainties can be reduced? So in our data, the primary one of the primary themes that came up was that uncertainty is very frequent when people received results from providers who lacked genetics expertise. Another one was receiving results by phone rather than in person. One of the parents said, the pediatrician didn't know anything. He was just reading me the information, so I was very confused after I got off the phone. Another one was that internet searches actually increased confusion for many people. There was a lot of misleading information that was obtained on the internet. And this was exacerbated when there were long waits to see geneticists. One parent said, we really didn't have a lot of information, so I was going crazy trying to figure it out. I wasn't understanding what I was reading. I didn't want to wait, so I was trying to figure it out on my own. Moving now to the practical sources of uncertainty that came up with multiple providers. Often, because the children have rare conditions and many different symptoms, they see different specialists and often received inconsistent information. One mother said, we were totally devastated by the initial results. The neurologist told me I had the same duplication as my child, and he had never seen that before. When I went to the genetic department, they said it's actually very common. Had I known, I probably would have been less stressed. One thing is that when a variant of uncertain significance is found, the parents are then tested in order to determine if it could be pathogenic. If the parent has the same variant as the child, usually it's considered to be benign, because if the parent is normal and the child has the same thing, it's not an issue. And it seems like that's what this parent had, but it wasn't understood by the provider who told her the result. On the other hand, the team approach actually improved understanding for some patients when all the members of the team were in the same place at the same time and could communicate with each other. It was very beneficial. This mother said everybody was there together giving us the information, and she found that helpful. In terms of the scientific sources of uncertainty, the main issue here are uncertain results and novel findings. So one of the parents said, do we have any idea what a duplication on the arm of the 13 or whatever it is, like what it actually could potentially mean? We have no idea. We'll know that just through time, I guess. But when you walk away knowing next to nothing, it is scary. And another parent said, there's not a whole wealth of information out there about this deletion. And she was right. There isn't. And the important thing is to clarify that there is no information out there so people don't go searching for something that doesn't exist. Also, that there was many instances when the results provided a causal explanation, but because they were so new, there was really no prognostic information. So they couldn't tell the parents, well, your child has this syndrome and this is what you can expect. They just said, well, we know that this is an abnormal genetic variation, but we don't know what this will mean for you in the future. So this parent said, it was good in that we had a diagnosis. But then it was just 100 more questions on top of that. The genetic counselor really didn't know anything more either. There were just no answers, really. So here we get the person who has genetics expertise. It's not because the provider doesn't have the information, but scientifically it's just not available. And then moving to personal sources of uncertainty, I'm just going to talk about one case example where a child was tested and he had a 1Q21.1 deletion. The father had the same deletion and read an article about this. It's a variant of uncertain significance, but there is some literature out there about it. But it's very wide in its range of, as you can see, can manifest with a range of developmental delay, neuropsychiatric abnormalities, which include schizophrenia, dysmorphic features, other things, and it's subject to incomplete penetrance and variable expressivity. So the father was a healthy individual. He had a PhD. He was very smart. He was a marathon runner, very healthy, had never had any problems. But he read this, and you can imagine what he would think. So this is how he reacted. For him, it raised very fundamental questions about his own sense of identity and concerns about stigma. He said, am I not a whole person? Can I be somebody else without missing chromosomes? And at first it was a shock. Now I'm labeled as this. And he was concerned. He said, will my employer and colleagues look differently on me? In the future, are they going to exclude these people with this deletion? I interviewed this man again after about 5 months, and he had checked this out with some members of his family and some of his colleagues at work, and the reaction was pretty much, well, so what? I mean, you're still you, and you haven't changed. So he hadn't really encountered any problems with this, but it still brought up some concerns for him, even though he hadn't really experienced anything negative in relation to that. So it can also, we found that it can reduce personal uncertainties. For many parents, having the diagnosis was a great relief. Even if it was a diagnosis of uncertain significance, it still provided relief for them. And it can alleviate guilt and blame that parents have been carrying around with them for a long time. One mother said, the health providers would always dig into my gynecological history. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't do drugs, I tried to do everything right. Having this test was finally the answer that she was wired this way. This really was the hand that God himself dealt us. And it's just important to note that this was a variant of uncertain significance. So even though we don't know what it means, this parent is taking it to mean that this is the cause of her child's problem, although she probably wasn't actually told that it was. So just to summarize the results from the parent interviews, there were 3 domains of uncertainty, the practical, the scientific, and the personal, and that we're looking to try to promote clarity and reduce the confusion by identifying which can and cannot be reduced among those uncertainties. So obviously the scientific uncertainty will remain, but the confusion can be reduced by reducing the other uncertainties. And that brings us to the benefits of the CMA testing, which is why people are getting tested, which that it can increase access to services. It can empower parents. One mother said it might be a tiny little segment of a chromosome, but it's a big frickin' stick in that next IEP meeting. It has empowered us. So it opens doors for children to get services in the classroom. It can allow connection with other parents. It would mean the world that somebody else somewhere out there has seen a child like mine, that we're not alone. And another parent said she wants to start a blog to see if there's anybody out there. So just moving now to the genetics providers interviews. These were with medical geneticists and genetics counselors. I'm not going to talk a lot about this. I just have one slide just to show that the information that we were receiving from the families was consistent with the information from the providers. So when they were talking about non-genetics providers especially, many of them said that they get families coming to them who have received results from other providers who are very confused. This quote sums it up. Non-genetics providers need to be prepared before they send a high-resolution test off to know that they are going to have to handle uncertainties. And many of them are not equipped to handle that. the family is sort of left with not quite knowing what that means. There's a high degree of anxiety because they have a positive result and they don't know what it means, and the provider's not able to explain. They just tell them to get to a geneticist as fast as possible. What would you do if someone tells you, here's your two-year-old, get to a geneticist? So I'm not going to talk more about these interviews, but just to say that this, I think, was very common in the interviews with the providers. And then after we did the qualitative analyses, we conducted an online survey, and we included the non-geneticists in the online survey. So now we can see what their experience of using the microarray test is. Is this borne out in their self-perceptions of their own use? So we had some medical geneticists, but mostly general pediatricians and pediatric subspecialists, and all of these people had been ordering microarray testing. We asked them what their comfort level was in explaining microarray results that could be normal, abnormal, and variant. And you can see that there are significant differences, and the least comfortable was the variant results. So people feel least comfortable explaining the uncertain results. And that was across the board. And then we also asked providers if they felt that they needed more education about microarray analysis, particularly interpreting and explaining the results to families. And for the non-geneticists, you can see that it's in the yellow. The need for education was very high, 5 and 4 for the non-geneticists, whereas for the geneticists it was only 2. And we asked how well the parents, they felt that most parents understand the results of microarray testing. And you can see that for the geneticists, in the last column, it was pretty high. Whereas for the non-geneticists, their perception of what parents understand is low. So it concurs again, it bears out that even when we ask them themselves, they're saying, we don't understand this, we need more education. And the families that we explain this to don't really understand this. So it's also shown in the informational resources we asked where they get information about microarray, and the non-geneticists tended to get it mostly from informal discussion, whereas for the geneticists, the non-genetics are in yellow and the genetics are in the darker color. It came from professional journals and CME courses, which is a more reliable source of that information. So looking over all the three studies, the barriers to comprehension, some of them are not reducible. It's hard to understand the scientific uncertainties and it's hard to explain them, and we can't do anything about unreliable information on the internet. But we can look at the reducible uncertainties and think, you know, how do we address these? So delivery of results by providers lacking expertise, insufficient pretest counseling, results being delivered by phone, long wait times to see geneticists, patients' own low rates of genetic literacy, and having difficulty connecting with other parents with the same problems were all barriers. When trying to address these barriers, I was challenged to, you know, when giving a talk like this, someone said, well, what can we do about this? And so it looks like what some of the problems are we don't have enough genetics professionals to cope with the increasing demand. And the non-genetic clinicians are now playing an increasing role, but they don't have the expertise to do it. And this has been written about and talked about for at least a decade, but the problem still remains. So it leads me to want to do something about it. And I'm going to go quickly through some potential policies that we could think about. At a system level, the rapid expansion in human genetics is straining existing healthcare systems. So we could increase the genetics workforce, we could train new providers, and nursing might be one area because that's the largest cohort of health providers that we have. Improving the communication between labs, clinical teams and the families might be another way to address that at the system level. At the provider level, training for non-genetics physicians and updating and disseminating guidelines. This might be done best through specialty societies. And another way is as primary care transforms itself to a medical home model, we need to think about how to incorporate genomics into that model and have more multidisciplinary visits so that the communication could happen maybe even directly from the lab to the family without going through a primary care physician who doesn't have the expertise to explain it. At the family level, developing more informational resources for families, and some people are talking about having to provide written consent for genomic testing. In some states, this is a requirement, but not where I am. And this might make it just more standard that people are getting the information up front and it has to be written down for them to actually take home with them. Creating more mechanisms for parents to connect with each other is important. Maybe some peer-to-peer counseling could be set up through the hospitals where they get the testing, even though they may not have the exact same result. They would need training because the problem is that if one person has a child with one problem and the other one, we don't want them thinking that, oh, my child is exactly like your child. So it would require some training, but it might also provide the support that they're looking for. So we've identified needs for genetic training, for non-genetics professionals, for more counseling provided by people with genetic competency, access for both families and non-genetics providers to genetics professionals, and for support networks for families. And we've suggested some policies, and when we have more discussion, I'd like to hear what people think about, you know, which ones can be implemented fairly quickly because it's a fairly urgent problem. So some of the questions when we get around to the discussion could be thinking about how we can help people cope with the uncertainties and how the policies could be implemented for the increased need for genetic professionals, for provider training, and improving resources for families. And I just want to acknowledge the many people who were part of this project at Penn, at CHOP, and elsewhere. My son, Alex Roseman, helped me with the slides.